Good evening, everybody. I haven't been in the hall too much today, but from the little I was in here, everything seems really wonderful, and I feel like it's rolling off to a great retreat. I hope that's the case, and I'm sure it'll continue. So I'll start with a bunch of kind of movie trailers, like millions of pretend talk titles, even though Dharma Talks don't have titles, and a few sort of fake or not fake epigraphs, and then I want to talk about a couple different things tonight. Part of it, I'll repeat some of what I said last night. I hope that's okay. I'll try to amplify it a little bit. So some possible pretend titles for the talk. Some practical tips for riding a dragon during a retreat. That's one. Catch a wave. That's another one. How to fall off a log. We'll talk about that later. A brief for fuzzy thinking and fuzzy being. And just to show my own age, the talking head, stop making sense. And here's a couple sort of epigraphs, which are sort of serious, sort of not. So Gateless Gate, case 20. And this is actually the first time I saw Sarah as a head of practice. She gave some encouraging words about this. But in the case, it's why can't the person of great strength lift up a leg? And Woman's Poem says, there's no place to put my whole body. Or in Shibayama's translation, there is no place to put this gigantic body. And then another one, which I'll try to make some sense out of a little bit later, but Denke, who's an 17th and 18th century Soto master, who wrote some wonderful comments on the Blue Cliff Record, says in a number of places this odd thing. He says, I throw it over to the other side. What other side? Other side of what? All right. And then just one more thing before we really get rolling. I'll just repeat the poem from Musa Soseki that Andrew read this morning, just because it makes that connection between water and flow and dragons that I'm really interested in. It's a really beautiful poem. It's called Old Creek. Since before anyone remembers, it has been clear, shining like silver, though the moonlight penetrates it and the wind ruffles it, no trace of either remains. Today I would not dare to expound the secret of the stream bed, but I can tell you that the blue dragon is coiled there. So kind of the first half of the talk is more or less the limits of clear thinking. So as I said last night, you know, we're asked, is riding the dragon a project? Well, at bottom, not really, because we're always already riding the dragon. And I'll read a little bit from the Hinton that I read last night and then pick him up in a minute, a few pages further on. This is from his I Ching. So as I read last night, primal emptiness separated into heaven and earth, that's how it all began. Before long, a pair of dragons emerged from Bright Prosperity Mountain, Root Breath and Lady Shi Voice. Now, dragons in ancient China embodied the awesome force of change. A dragon was in constant transformation, writhing through all creation and all destruction, shaping itself into the 10,000 things, tumbling through their ceaseless transformations. So a lot of times, even though we're always riding that dragon, how could we not be riding it? We don't realize it or we don't acknowledge it. But I think a lot of times also it's we kind of prefer not to. Dragons are mostly not malevolent. They're often really benevolent, as Andrew suggested, in Chinese myth and legend and in Zen stories. But there's also this from Hinton's I Ching again. I Ching. It's from the I Ching, but he's talking about both the Tao Te Ching and the I Ching. So the Tao Te Ching describes the way's most fundamental form as return. It says, return is the movement of the way, and the 10,000 things arise, and in them I watch the return. All things on and ever on, each returning to its root. And Hinton says, return is also spoken of as an essential in the I Ching, where there is a hexagram dedicated to it, 24, return. The elaborations on this hexagram say, all return penetrating everywhere, things emerge and die back. And in return itself, you can see the very heart-mind of all heaven and earth. And then Hinton again, The 10,000 things emerge from and return to a root or source from which they appear, from which they reappear in a new form. That's also benevolent, not just malevolent. Nevertheless, at least to me, it might sometimes feel at least a little bit daunting. I'm reminded of a kind of wonderfully wry, I guess, line in a John Ashbery poem. He says, better you said to stay cowering like this in the early lessons. You know, let's stay in the grade school version of being a person, not go out into Dragonland. All right. So I'm going to come back now to a case that Andrew mentioned, Blue Cliff Record 2. It's got, a scarier evocation of a dragon in it. And I'm going to take it into a little bit different terrain than Andrew did, which is part of the fun of playing around with the Coens, especially in the open source. There isn't just one place to take it. So here's from Schwedo's poem on the case. So this is about kind of scary dragons, and then it'll hook up to something else. When the skull's consciousness is exhausted, how can joy remain? In a dead tree, the dragon murmurs are not yet exhausted. Difficult, difficult. So the commentary ends, or at least includes, a celebration of these dragon energies and of that sense of return or dying back, of the weaving and unweaving of each individual creature. So Yuan Wu, in his interlinear comment on the poem, says, he's great, so kind of grouchy and brave, he says, "Bah! The dead tree blooms again. Bodhidharma travels through the eastern land." You know, not to worry, right? Okay. And then, as Andrew also quoted further on in the case, when someone asked, "What are dragon murmurings in a dead tree?" Xishuang answered, "Still having joy." So to be with that. Yet and still, here's another part of the commentary on the case. A student asked about these dragon murmurings, "Who can hear this?" Xiaoshan said, "In the whole world, there is no one who does not hear it." The student asked, what book is dragon murmurings taken from? Xiaoshan said, "I don't know what book it's from, but all who hear it die." I really love that, you know, the student wanting to get clear, sort of asking his diligent scholarly question, what book is Dragon Murmurings taken from? And that impulse to get clear, which seems kind of daffy here, right, takes us right back actually to the main case, which is about clarity and lack of clarity. So there's some connection between what the main case is going to talk about and, I don't know what book it's from. Don't worry about getting clear about it, but all who hear it die. And then the student sort of determinedly, tell me what book it's from. I just want to be clear about this and everything will be okay. So here's the case. Zhao Zhou taught, the greatest way isn't difficult if you don't pick and choose. As soon as I speak, you'll think that's picking and choosing or that's clear. But I don't identify with clarity. And then he says this really odd thing. He says, but I don't identify with clarity. Can you live like that? A student asks, if you don't identify with clarity, what do you live by? And Jiaxia says, I don't know. But it's like the student can't leave it alone. He really, really wants a clarification. You know, he says, if you don't know, why do you say that you don't identify with clarity? And Jiaxia answers really crucially. This is the newest translation by Joan. I love this one. He says, you're asking about a matter you already grasp. Make your bow and step back. So, do this again. I don't identify with clarity. Can you live like that? If you don't identify with clarity, what do you live by? I don't know. If you don't know, why do you say that you don't identify with clarity? You're asking about a matter you already grasp. Make your bow and stand back. So when Zhao Zhou asks, can you live like that, I think he's not just saying, you know, here's an intellectual challenge or something, but there's something really scary about not identifying with clarity. And it's certainly not for mere intellectual satisfaction that the student needs to be clear. So as Zhao Zhou says, you're asking about a matter you already grasp. And I think that pinpoints the student's motivation. It's not just an innocent wish to understand or know or get clear. It's an avoidance of something that he already in some way knows but doesn't want to know. Or maybe to put it differently, something that already knows him. And so we're back to Hinton again. all return, penetrating everywhere. Things emerge and die back. So if not identifying with clarity in this koan involves really letting the dragon in, letting the process in, letting, you know, all who hear it die, letting all that in, then one of the things we learn, I think, is that in some way there's an identification between clarity and the function of keeping the scary aspects of things at bay, keeping us safe from all of them. So that's the, you know, I'd rather stay here cowering in the early lessons. One component of that is what Freud called magic thinking, you know, as if sort of clear thinking would have not just a practical power, but in that clarity somehow we'd separate ourselves and get safe from all those things. So again, the kind of frightening and demanding quality of Jiazhou's question, I don't identify with clarity, can you live like that? So here's kind of the mother of all koans, just another one more quickly, that has something to do with clarity. And it's the mother of all koans because it's about the kalpa-ending fire, you know, the fire that will end the entire universe. And there's another great student here, you know. It sounds like he just wants an A in the course, you know, but it's really about something else. So this is Dashui's fire at the end of the kalpa. And Cleary is a great translator. So a student asked Dashui, "It's clear that the fire at the end of this kalpa will completely destroy the universe. I'm still not clear whether there's something that won't be destroyed." This is not an innocent question, right? Dashui said, "It will be destroyed." And here's another student who can't leave it alone, you know. It's like, could not possible, right? Okay. Like an intellectual dog kind of worrying an intellectual bone, it seems like. He says, "It'll, whatever it is, right? It'll leave along with everything else." And Dashui says, "It'll leave along with everything else." And for the student, in some way, it's as if it's impossible that getting clear or being clear or having a good understanding wouldn't involve some kind of magical exemption or be some kind of get-out-of-jail-free card. So, you know, that's some of the function of being clear, I think. And it's one of the reasons I think that clear thinking is not the best way to spend your time in a retreat. Okay? So, just then this talk is probably an example of it. So let me infix a couple things. So first of all, clear, and this is really obvious stuff, but clearly it isn't just magic thinking, you know, the sense that clear thinking or modeling could, you know, give us a leg up in some way, right? That clear thinking or model making is pretty clearly functional in a lot of ways. It gets us out of a lot of jams. It's possibly humanity's key adaptive trait. William James, in the book Pragmatism, talks about the instrumental value of thinking and the instrumental function. So he says, you know, models or truths or things that we say to ourselves, they don't have some kind of just abstract status. They're instruments. They're like tools that we use to get a hold of things. And so part of the Jamesian thing is you're going to change and modify your models to fit the situation and your purposes and all that. But one of the things people say is that pragmatism in American philosophy was kind of an outgrowth of Darwinian natural selection. And that partly these guys were saying, oh, thinking must have an adaptive value, right? So clearly, you know, model making and all that is really tremendously useful. But I would suggest that our practice is partly, not entirely, but crucially about coming into relation with the recalcitrant aspects of our experience and our life that are not susceptible to this sort of management. So kind of given that up. I want to do, I hope I can do this really quickly, a kind of short, I'm an English professor, so kind of short day job yammer. So I'll try to keep it really short. But so one of the things we know for sure is that kind of triaging function of language, though it's probably biaging because we're binary, you know, yes, no, right, wrong. But that kind of triaging of experience has a tremendous, again, sort of instrumental power. So, you know, we know that, and we also know that the binaries are in some way artificial or instrumental, and they're not built into reality exactly. Another thing that's probably just as clear, but that linguists and others say, is that all of that in some way depends on a kind of prior sorting or separating. And the prior sorting or separating really is between the knowing and judging subject, you know, the person who learns to manipulate language, and the world over there. So in some way, the kind of first binary is, I'm over here predicating, judging, and so on, and the world is over there, and I'll make further binaries. So Hinton talks about this, a lot of other people do too. It's not that surprising in a way that we have this sense of clear thinking as sort of keeping us separate and exempt, you know, not in it, but over against it, kind of manipulating it to our own advantage. All right. So as I just said, you know, a lot of value in that, but the limitations of it are really obvious. And in some way, dragon, I think, is a figure for those limitations, you know, the kind of immense power, things in the universe we can't control, whether it's our own death or dying, climate change, things like that. And another thing that's probably worth pointing out is that even when things are going well, probably about, you know, 99.9 plus percent of what's keeping us going is not a function of our modeling. I mean, it's just, you know, part of the world we're in and biology and all those things that keep it afloat, right? Okay. It's interesting, though, that the Buddhist tradition stresses that it's incredibly lucky to be born human, right? So I want to be clear that this is not a kind of fundamentalism, like language bad, human thinking bad, got to get out of it, right? So a little digression, and I'll tell the kinky part just because it's fun. But this is actually 1950s TV, I think. So Groucho Marx had a show, I can't remember the name of it, but where he would bring certain people on for a kind of quiz thing, but he would interview them in a way. And this is the not directly relevant part, though, kind of. So there's some guy on there, and he asked him to tell him about his situation. And the guy says he has like 11 kids or something like that. And Groucho kind of goes, 11 kids? And the guy who's pretty witty says, oh, I love my wife. You know, right? And then this I love because it's the sort of 1950s moment of non-heteronormative TV. What Groucho says is, so I love my wife. Groucho says, well, I love my cigar, but I take it out of my mouth every once in a while. it's funny, it's a rejoinder, and it's you know, it's wonderful in all kinds of ways. So what I want to use from that, though, is like, thinking is great, right? You know, model making is great, but we should take the cigar out of our mouths every once in a while and see what else is going on. So there's that. All right. So on this view of things, then, awakening is not a kind of perfected knowing. And there are strands in the tradition that talk almost like sort of Superman X-ray vision. You know, if you're being philosophical, I used to know mere phenomena, and now I know noumena. You know, it's like I know exactly the essence of the way things are. And the last several years, anyway, that's been kind of not the main take on it, but I think there are strands throughout the tradition that would suggest that that's not really the case. And so what I'm suggesting, in a way, is that part of our project is not to become a better knower, but in a way just to be a thing in the world, right? Okay. There's a really beautiful thing that I've only read about because my dogs are not very well behaved, but in dog training, apparently like one of the last stages, it's called the dog will stand for examination. And what that means is like you bring your dog, I've only read about this, you bring your dog to the class and you tell it to stand for examination, and you can step away from the dog and the dog will let other people that it doesn't really know sort of touch it, you know? And I mean, you could regard that as a kind of brutality, but you could also regard it as a kind of deep trust and availability. So there's a way in which to be a dog standing for examination is one, you know, one goal of Zen practice. So I want to read, this will take a couple of minutes, and I'm sorry, but this is Dale Wright from Philosophical Meditations on Zen Buddhism. And it's kind of funny in a way because he's an important practitioner, I think, and he's written on the paramitas, and he and the Soto Zen teacher, Norman Fisher, are always sort of trading, oh, you're better than I am, oh, you should, I don't need to write the book because you wrote it and all that. So he's pretty deeply involved in the tradition. But in a way, it's like a philosopher's clear statement about the limits of clarity. So just, there are four, I think, fairly brief quotations, but it'll take a couple minutes. So he's talking about the Wangbo early text, Transmission of Mind. It says, therefore, the Wangbo texts have Bodhidharma pose the challenge of enlightenment as follows. When we recognize the nature of mind, all we can say is that it is unthinkable. In understanding, nothing is attained. When we obtain it, we cannot say we know. When I teach you this matter, can you withstand it? So that's really like the Zhaozhou. When I teach you this matter, can you withstand it? And then Dale Wright says, enlightenment in this image is a human comportment in view of the abandonment of all solid grounds, including the search for such grounds. Release into the experience is simultaneous with release of all claims to possess, to grasp, and to know. It follows the concept emptiness into its denial of all claims to truth and absoluteness, including its own claim to know something itself, something ultimately truthful about all claims. Then on the next page he says, this expanse of openness is described as difficult and anxiety-provoking. Opening to larger spheres beyond the self discloses the self's groundlessness and mortality, its own emptiness. In this sense, enlightenment is not simply a matter of personal fulfillment, a psychological self-improvement. Instead, abandoning the security of self-understanding, it entails exposure to transpersonal contexts beyond the self. It's getting a little purple, but and then the next page. The process of Zen practice is thought to lead not to definitive knowledge or grounding in certainty, but rather to an openness better characterized by letting go. Therefore, the literature of Wangbo does not propose a conception of the true self, nor does it conclude in any account of the way things really are. Instead, it suggests practices of thought and images of masters who let go of thought even while thinking. And then finally, more briefly, to be enlightened then is to be a willing and open respondent, to have achieved an open reciprocity with the world through certain dimensions of self-negation. So that's kind of part one. So then the project in some way is how to be where we already are, you know, how in some sense to slide out of the position of the knower, standing over against things and getting clear about it. And we don't have to do it, we just have to let it happen. Right? Joan used to say, not specifically Joan Sutherland, but in general about things in a retreat, say, when you get here, we get to a certain thing going on in practice, you don't have to try to do any more, you just have to do a little less. Okay. So that's the falling off a log part, you know. It's like, oh, you don't have to. It's as easy as falling off a log, right? You know, and of course it would be really hard to fall off a log, right? It's like if I put a log, right? I couldn't do it. Right? It's scary, right? Okay. So these are kind of a couple of practice things, I suppose, or possible practices that involve, you know, falling off a log, and a number of them are kind of like, sort of, gently or slowly or surreptitiously slipping off the log or sliding off the log, and I'll talk about those. And then the other one is like the big whoops banana peel moment. So boom, you're off the log. And I want to talk a little bit about both of those. All right. And again, here I'll be repeating and amplifying a little bit on some things I said last night. Okay. So I think it's the movie Blow Up, the Antonioni movie, where there's a guy trying to solve a crime, and so he makes more and more, you know, picture blow-ups of what's happened. And he's able, I mean, it's thinking on steroids, you know, you can compare this image to that image, blow up this one, blow up the other one. And so there's this kind of recursive looping back process so he can get clearer and clearer and clearer and clearer on what happened, right? So if that's true, and here comes the dragon again, one of the ways to not be doing that is to sort of slide into flow, right? So, you know, things are recursive and they get that way, but to the extent possible, we just sort of let them go, right? All right. And almost all these, to go back to that notion of the knower standing over against the known, almost all of these are things that in some way sort of blur the distinction between myself and the world. There are ways in which, I don't know, my kind of odd thinking sort of slides me into the world, or my body sense sort of carries me on the flow of things that are already happening. So, you know, I don't disappear as a knowing subject, but it kind of isn't the main thing going on sometimes. All right. They're all things that I've found useful, and I think they're, I mean, in a way it's probably a joke to say this is sort of practical advice, but these are all things that I think are retreat friendly, so if you find any of them happening, they might be useful. So again, I mentioned some of these last night, but one of the things I find often in retreat is I kind of lose the, and you know, I'm a professor, so I'm definitely a recursive thinker, but I sort of find myself losing the thread of my thinking. You know, it's just I'm getting too dreamy, or something got too strange, and thoughts are just kind of flowing along, and even if I try to sort of loop back and make sense of them, I have a hard time doing that, all right? It's also true, I think, that koans are really good for that, you know, that there's a way in which I think we all kind of stand outside the koan and try to figure out what it means or make sense of it, and what I find when I do that a lot of times is, and I know I'm not supposed to be doing it, you know, but it's like, I almost got it. You know, it's like there's one more step and it'll all fit together. And then it just goes, whoops, you know, and it's just the kind of clarity goes away at that point. And then I'm just a couple things. Then in a way, I'm just sort of inside the landscape of the koan and I'm dreaming with it, or it's dreaming me, or I'm seeing the things, but I also am the things. So if you think, for example, about that koan that a lot of us love, this is the stone drenched with rain that points the way. A kind of initial thing as well, like, what does the stone mean? What does the rain mean? What's the way mean? or how can I figure out how I can use this, or even in a way, what are the 11 things in my life that are like the stone, and what are the 9 things that are like the rain, which is somewhat more useful. But I think at some point, you know, you're just kind of being with the stone and the rain, in a way you are the stone, or you are the rain, or you are the way. And, you know, that's already kind of slipping into things. And all those things in some way are you, all right? There's another Xiaozhou koan that, for this notion of just sort of thinking that's not recursive, that's just flowing along, makes crucial use of water. And so I want to use that as a kind of bridge to something else. And again, it's a koan that's probably familiar to a lot of you. It's Bluecliff Record, Case 80, Xiaozhou's Mind of a Newborn Baby. A student asked Xiaozhou, does a newborn baby have consciousness? Xiaozhou, so with explaining, so in that system, there are 5 sense consciousnesses, like for the 5 senses. And then for us, this is a little weird, but the 6th one is conscious. So just like, you know, hearing has sounds as its object, the 6th one is consciousness that has thoughts as its object, which is not really the way we think about it. But so that would be, I guess, the more accurate translation. Does a newborn baby have the 6th consciousness to kind of make an object of its own thoughts, right? Okay. A student asked Xiaozhou, that's that recursive thing, right? A student asked Xiaozhou, does a newborn baby have consciousness? Xiaozhou said, tossing a ball on rushing waters. The student went on to ask Tozi, because I'm still not clear, right? What does tossing a ball on rushing waters mean? Tozi said, moment after moment, it never stops flowing. Okay, and that's riding the dragon for sure. And interestingly enough, by the way, that turns out to be what Wei Nung in the Platform Sutra means by no thought. It isn't sort of clearing the mind of all thoughts, but, you know, woo, you know, absence thinking. Right? So one of the things I love about this, I think, is it's possible to spend time with it, and you say, oh, it's a metaphor, so it's a metaphor for thinking. And that's pretty explicit in the koan. It's the thinking that, you know, just like tossing a ball on rushing water. But I think it's impossible to spend time with the koan and not have it begin to have a body component. It's impossible, at least for me, you know, I'm riding down the stream with it, right? So that's important, I think, because crucially, a lot of koans will do that. They'll give you a sort of felt body sense of movement or flow. And that body sense also, of course, is often very powerful in a retreat. Another thing to say about that is at that moment, it isn't just flow, but it's also buoyancy. The sense in some way we're not doing it all ourselves, we're being, you know, kept afloat in some way by that water, by the buoyancy. But again, the body experience, I think, is really crucial. So a lot of times in a koan, we'll have a sort of kinetic bodily sense of it. I want to say one other thing about that. So there are lots and lots of images, of course, that have water in them, and there's that sense of being buoyed up. Another thing to say, this sounds a little goofy, but I mean, air for sure is not a vacuum, right? We're not usually moving in water, we're moving in air. There's a really cool story about Graham Peachy, who was apparently going to be a Suzuki Dharma heir, but he stayed in England too long and kind of missed that particular wave. But he went to a 30-day retreat in England for an important Zen teacher who had died. And this is from Crooked Cucumber, the biography of Suzuki. And there's a story, he says, by about halfway through the retreat, he could hear the bugs crawling on the floor behind him. So there's this really, really heightened sensorium. And one of my experiences, and I'm sure people have had similar things, is like one retreat, like watching a fly on my wrist, and I could see the eye opening and closing really quickly. So there is this kind of heightened sensorium. And one of the things that'll happen in a retreat sometimes, especially if you're at that stage where you don't have to try to do any more, you just need to do a little less, is you really can feel, you know, the buoyancy of the medium. Like if you're on a long walk or you're doing Kenyan, you can feel the air in some way buoying you up, you know. And so that's important. We really are supported, you know, if it were a vacuum, we'd all fall down, right? We really are supported by it. We don't have to do it all by ourselves. People also talk sometimes in moments where things are opening up about a feeling of the light as being kind of thick and viscous. So that quality of light and air as supportive is pretty wonderful. But then more generally, you know, just that sort of body sensation. I want to talk a little bit more about what I mentioned last night about kinetic identification, which is kind of a geeky term for it. But just what I mean by it is, you know, we can see or hear something. We'll see a tree limb moving across the courtyard, or we'll hear the sound of a bird. And you get a sense of, Well, with the tree, it's like you can feel the movement of the tree in your body. It's like there's this kind of echo that you don't have to try for. And I think certain people are more susceptible to it than others, but it's like, oh, the tree's right there in your body. And I think sometimes with like a bird call, you have the experience like, and it's not accurate exactly, but you know, it's like you can feel the call coming out of your, like your head in some fantasized way, like it feels like a bird said. And you're doing that. And in that moment, we're sort of catching some particular movement and rhythm, and we're kind of lifted out of ourselves, right? So William Carlos Williams, the poet, he's talking about poets, but he says wonderfully that they are, or we are, right, taught by the largeness of their imaginations to feel every form which they see moving within themselves. Let's read that one more time. Taught by the largeness of their imaginations to feel every form which they see moving within themselves. Right, and so that's a little bit like sort of catching the rhythm of a dance or something like that. But here, you know, we catch the movement of some particular thing, and that's one of the reasons I brought in the denke. You know, I throw it over to the other side. What other side? Other side of what? And in those moments, I think it's we who are kind of thrown over to the other side. You know, we're with those things. We're carried out of ourselves in some way. So this afternoon for the reading, we read the Shuto taking part in the gathering. And I wanted, in relation to this kinetic thing, just mention the lines, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven, and this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. So sometimes that kinetic thing can feel like the interweaving. There's a sense of sort of fluidity, flow, everything kind of flowing together. And poetry can evoke this pretty nicely. So here are just a few kind of weird and wonderful lines from Walt Whitman. Says, earth of the slumbering and liquid trees, earth of departed sunset, earth of the mountains misty topped, earth of the vitreous pour of the full moon just tinged with blue, earth of shine and dark mottling the tide of the river. Or in another place, the smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch and vine, my respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag. One of the great things he does there is this kind of movement between internal body sensations and external ones. And also, it's notable also, there's no verbs, like he's not asserting anything. It's just this kind of flow, of the kind of buzz of being, right? So at other times, the kinetic thing can be more like each thing standing in its own place. You know, so we're struck by the kind of tathagata or the thusness, you know, the kind of spectacular individual presence of some particular thing. So again, as I mentioned last night, Keats says in one of his letters, or if a sparrow come before my window, I take part in its existence and pick about the gravel. And that doesn't feel like blending exactly, but in some way, the sparrow's exactly itself, but it's not one, not two. We're not the sparrow, and we're not the sparrow, right? There's a line in Whitman, the geese nip their food with short jerks, which is really great, and it's very accurate in some way. And here's a great short poem by William Carlos Williams, who a lot of times just was interested in nothing more than that and thought that that was enough to make a poem. It's a little poem called As the Cat, right? So, as the cat climbed over the top of the jam closet, first the right forefoot, carefully, then the hind stepped down into the pit of the empty flower pot. And I mean, all that does is invites you, you know, to sort of move with the cat. And he's sort of using the line breaks to give that sense of sort of muscularity and movement. All right. So that's related. So I remember going to a farewell thing for somebody up at Pacific Zen Institute a long time ago. And, you know, because she was leaving to move north to be with her family. And as part of the little talk she gave, she said, the two scariest words in the English language are show me. So if you do work in the room, you know the thing about it, it's time to make a presentation, show me. So it can feel in a way like you're sort of being put on the spot or you're being tested or something like that. But it's exactly about, you know, that sort of kinetic thing, like take it into your own body, show me what it's like to be that. And a number of the Coens, you know, really do that in a really strong way. They invite that. So, you know, these are all from the miscellaneous. Make the mountains dance. So, well, my opinion about how, show me, you know, make the mountains dance. Right? Go straight up the mountain road with 99 curves. I mean, that doesn't feel like a deep Dharma point in a way, but it's an invitation to do this kind of thing. Why does the Russian River flow west to the sea? That's another one. And then this one, it's kind of a trick. Are dolphins really as smart as people say they are? Well, I think kind of, well, no, something else, right? And again, Williams, just to repeat it, taught by the largeness of their imaginations to feel every form which they see moving within themselves. Okay, just a couple more things. So Kelly, again, you know, talked about going off clock time. And one of the things I feel when I'm on clock time is that human clock time is the common denominator and the kind of mathematical measuring thing for everything else that's going on. Oh, this takes 10 minutes, this takes 7 minutes. As soon as clock time goes away, there isn't, like, there's no Greenwich, there's no single standard, you know? So all you get is these kind of different tempos of things moving, and no one of them is the master one, so you can feel this sort of interweaving of tempos, including your own. And I won't go through the whole drill again, but some of them are really quick, some of them are slow. And again, in the desert, there's this sense of some really, really, you know, incredibly slow-moving time that borders on stillness. And you can feel the movement of your own body sort of in counterpoint or interweaving with those time signatures. And in some way, you're feeling, in some more general way, those times moving through your body. So again, these are all versions of what I'm maybe not the best possible term, but talking about is kind of fuzzy thinking. So just a couple more. So another thing that might happen, and this is a, sort of in praise of blurriness again, you know, we're be present, you know, okay, I'm being present. One of the really strange things about that that I've just been thinking about recently is if the deal is to be present, why are we spending time with Coens? You know, here I am sitting in the hall in Tucson, it's like, this is the stone drench with, well, I'm not being present to that, you know, so there's this odd thing about presence and imagination and all that. So one of the things that may happen, especially if you get tired during a retreat, which is often a good thing, is that you just kind of get dreamy, and I find especially, kind of without rhyme or reason, sort of landscapes from memory, often from many years ago, just kind of go drifting through my head, and I find some of them are recurrent, you know, but there isn't a story about it, you know, oh, that reminds me of when my mother was mean to me or something like that. There's just the wall of these stones, you know, or there's just the grass, or there's just a particular tree, or there's just a particular porch or a particular window without kind of rhyme or reason. And one of the ways that's talked about in the tradition is as the storehouse consciousness. And that's that kind of stuff that, in a way, is a record of the stuff that makes it through the sensorium. It's like the preconscious in Freud that we don't bother to sort of cogitate and have propositions or stories about. But it's all in there, you know? And just to spend time with that can be a practice. I don't want to say too much about that, but I will say, and this is something that Joan Sutherland really stresses, within the tradition, that storehouse consciousness, which is it's the eighth consciousness, and it's also called the Alaya Vijnana, it's understood as the Tathagatagarbha. It's the womb of the Buddhas. And I think the idea is that, you know, among other ways, in those sense memories without rhyme or reason, where, of course, there's a great story by Maurice Sendak, Mickey in the Night Kitchen, where there's a little boy whose mom is pregnant, and he's kind of freaked out by it, so he goes down to the kitchen at night and bakes himself a cake, right? But he falls into the batter, and he keeps saying, I'm in the milk, and the milk's in me. I'm in the milk. And so in this Alaya Vijnana thing, it's like, I'm in the world, and the world's in me. I'm in the world, and the world's in me. They're all mixed up. And the idea is that in some way, like spending time with that and just turning a little bit, that's already awakening. So that seems really important. And again, it's, you know, I'm not over here cognizing and making predications about the world. Okay, almost done, but I want to talk a little bit about the sort of big banana peel thing, you know, sort of what happens when it just, whoops, there it goes, you know. Or as Joan Sutherland says, the rug gets pulled out from under. So one of the really famous ones, which I'll mention just briefly, is that story of Shuelio going to see Great Master Ma, and it says, well, you know, what's going on with your school? And Ma just kicks him in the chest and knocks him down. And Shuelio apparently, this is in Joan's book, stands up laughing and applauding. And then he says, ever since Great Master Ma kicked me, I have not stopped laughing. So that's that moment. He's just a body. He gets like knocked over. And you would think it's just disconcerting, but it's this big kind of, you know, he's really off the lock in that moment. The one I want to mention, because I love it, because it kind of does double duty. Another thing that might happen is rather than getting physically knocked over, you just might lose your bearings. So all of a sudden you realize you're really tired and you're driving to retreat and you're driving through Deming and you have to make the turn to Hatch, but you miss the turn and you're really tired and you have no, for just a moment, you have no idea where you are or why you're there, you know, and it's like, oh, you know, and then you kind of pick up on it. But so this is a story about, maybe I'll just tell it. It's a story about Musō Sōseki, who goes on to be a great teacher, and he's with one teacher and things are not going well. And he kind of says, you know, can you say a turning word for me? Can you say something that will open up? He says, there's no turning word in our school. It's not quite true, but that's what the teacher says. And then he says, can you at least give me your compassion? He says, there's no compassion. It's also not just, it turns out to be a compassionate statement, but you wouldn't think so. So anyway, he sort of had it, and he goes and works with another teacher, but spends a lot of time, you know, out by himself at night meditating. And it's not a hermit, but it's a little bit like that, you know. So one night, he's been meditating really late, and he wants to walk back to where he sleeps. And of course, he knows it so well because he walks it every night, right? And so he knows that there's a like a shed or something like that, and there's a wall there. So he puts out his hand, you know, to lean against the shed, and it's not there, and he just falls, you know. And at that moment, he sort of bursts out laughing, and it's this big opening, and you know, it's a little aggressive, but there's this kind of spectacular thing where he says he felt like he I crushed the bones of the sky or something. But he also says, after all this exile, you know, now I'm home, which is really strange, you know, because it's this moment of, I've lost my bearings, I don't know where I am, I can't model the thing, and I'm just a body, it's like a pratfall, it's like a banana peel moment. He's just, it's like a dog standing for examination in some way, and that's it. He's really, really at home, you know. So there's that, and that can happen. It's a kind of end to exile that can happen to us sometimes. Right? One thing I will say about that is it's probably a good thing to have a practice, and one thing that people say is, if people, one thing that Zennies say, is that if people have experiences like this without some kind of preparation, it's just kind of disconcerting. So there's a way in which sitting the way we do and practicing the way we do, we're kind of making a place and a context for that experience so that this other thing can happen, right? And the kind of textbook version of it, and I think it's, even though it's sort of aggressive with the breaking the bones of the sky or whatever it is in the Musa Soseki, the kind of textbook thing is, one of the results of that moment, and it's got a relation to dragon, is this feeling of this kind of tremendous energy that just flows right through you. You know, this power flows through you. And so in a way, there's a kind of two-step process, at least in the kind of classic Zen narrative, one of sort of losing one's bearings, letting go, and that gets mapped onto this thing called the Great Death, you know, so it's, oops, that, you know. And then the other one would be the sort of welling up of dragon right through us, and that has something to do with the great rebirth. So I want to end, almost end, not quite, but with a two koan sequence, and I won't say much about them because they'll turn up later in the retreat, but like some of the stuff that Andrew was talking about, this is one kind of fortuitously where snakes and dragons are mingling freely. So the first, and they're both about Yunmen, so the first one is Blue Cliff Record, case 22, and Joan Sutherland's note says, it's about a turtle-nosed snake, which sounds kind of goofy, you know, it sounds like Disney, but it says, possibly a cobra. The turtle-nosed snake is ancient, gnarled, and venomous. So it's got some dragon power. So here's the koan. And Yunmen's a student in this one, and the teacher is Shui Feng. So Shui Feng said to the assembly, there's a turtle-nosed snake on South Mountain. All of you should have a good look. Changxing says, there definitely are people in this hall today who could lose their lives. And then this is great. Yunmen threw his staff down in front of Shui Feng and made a show of being frightened. Ah! You know, so that's really important. Then Blue Cliff Record, case 60. In a way, this is, having done that, here's what might happen. Yunmen, he's now a teacher, Yunmen held up his staff and said to the assembly, this staff becomes a dragon. It has swallowed the whole universe. The rivers, the mountains, rivers, and great earth, where do they come from? So this is a moment, I think, go back to Andrew's talk again, which isn't what does the dragon want, or what the, you know, what would Jesus do, right? What would the dragon do, right? But what is the dragon doing? You know, it's just that simple and that direct. I also feel that Yunmen here is standing at a really important kind of hinge place between decreation and creation, emptiness and form, Hinton's absence and presence, or eternity and time. He's really standing at the place before those things get separated out. So I want to end by really jumping traditions and evoking another version of this hinge place, and begins to talk a little bit about kind of once we put the cigar back in our mouths, you know, once we come back to making propositions and all, maybe things are slightly changed, and this offers some description of what that change is like. I also like this, weirdly enough, because I'd already planned on doing this, but it really reminds me of toward the end of Andrew's talk, when he was talking about, first of all, the emperor who he associated with kind of ego, what did you call it, ego?
Yeah, the ego, the Jade Emperor.
Yeah, but so yeah, ego, the ego position, or
controlling and all that.
Oh, yeah, the ego controlling. Yeah, so that's in there, and then also the other emperor, you know, who sort of works, bends the river and works with the flow, and weirdly enough, so this is like this is like from psychoanalysis, and it's Freud and Lacan, which would seem like a really unlikely place to end this up, but so here's Freud. And this translation, anyway, this is from the new introductory lectures from the dissection of the psychical personality. And in this translation, it's like sort of toward the end. And at least in the standard edition, you know, here's the translation. There where id was, let ego be. And then he says, I love this, it's an endless task like the draining of the Zuiderzee, which would have been one of those areas in Holland where you had the dikes, but you had to keep draining it. And it really feels like a colonialist kind of image, you know, where the unknown, where the dragon was, where the id was, let ego be, let's keep draining it, you know, conquering that territory for the self. And Lacan, who was really scornful of American ego psychology, and this is, again, English translation, so who knows what the French was, but he recasts it in this really beautiful way. So again, the Freud is, there where id was, let ego be, da-dum, you know, it's an endless task like the draining of the Zuiderzee. And Lacan says in this really odd phrasing, there where it was, I should like it to be understood. It is my duty that I should come to being. There where it was, I should like it to be understood. It is my duty that I should come to being. So we emerge exactly in that place and as a function of it and as an outgrowth of it. And that is not mastering the dragon. That is not taming the dragon. That's, again, Yunmen, you know, the staff has become a dragon and has swallowed the universe, the mountains, rivers, and great earth. Where do they come from? So, thank you. And I welcome any conversation. We have a little time. Yeah, so any conversation would be welcome. Or not.
What do you say after that?
Say, I don't believe it.
I'm not sure if it's a question.
Anything, yeah.
Or my own clarification. Speaking of clarification, so... I don't know what's coming up to my mind, and I apologize. I was kind of like drifting in that a lot, which
that's good.
Which is kind of fun, but it seems like that clarification is non-clarifying.
Yeah. There's a place where the urge to clarify is obscuring something else. Yeah. And I mean, crucially, it's
like medicating.
Yeah. And there's a gigantic terrain where that's not true, right? Where clear thinking is really a good deal, you know. But but I think again, a lot of our practice is about that place where thinking won't save you. You know, clear thinking won't save
you. Yeah, I want my searching to be clear thinking.
Yeah. So that's what I meant by it's not a fundamentalism. Yeah. You know, I mean that way we're terrible to be human.
I don't know. I want my surgeon to have done a lot of clear thinking.
But and in the moment he can put that aside.
Yeah, I hope so.
It's often, but it's not. I've been working with video, trying to create a video of something that we did, and there's optical focus, and it gives it a nice clear picture, but it's not close enough. So I try to zoom in electronically.
Yeah. Oh, and it doesn't. You try and get clear, and it won't get clear.
No longer clear.
Let me
pushing
say.
Pushing it too hard.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That reminded me actually of I don't remember it that clearly blow up, but I do remember these very fuzzy images.
Oh, yeah.
So you know he solves the mystery by getting into more and more fuzzy images.
Yeah.
Actually, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so something else plays out. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Let me say one. I know I talked a lot, but let me just say one other thing because it's kind of crossed my mind and came up and might be important. So, So what, another thing in Freud that I really like is that he was talking about dreams, and he says, so, you know, in dreams, like, the unconscious plays a crucial role, but also consciousness plays a role. And so he talks about dreams as compromise formations, by which he doesn't mean, you know, let's both have the hamburger or something like that, but that the dream is a function of both, you know, consciousness contributes to the formation of the dream, and so does the unconscious. So I think one of the ways we sort of come back, you know, from the moment of falling off the log is in this kind of a sense of compromise formation, that we're back in consciousness, we're back in modeling and clear thinking, but in some way, a lot of that other experience stays with us. And so some of the times during the day, we're in this kind of compromised state where both those things are going on. Another way to talk about that is, if we think about the ego also as the sort of self or the interpreter, one, and this is really crucial to Cohen work and the sort of integration, that in a way the self learns to tell stories that don't have the self at the center. And that's one of the things it can bring back. So that's, again, that sort of compromise that seems really, really crucial. Yeah.
This I don't know if this is a question or a comment, but the concept of the dragon is something that's kind of revelatory to me, and not something that I was accustomed to thinking. Or I didn't understand the title of this retreat when it was presented. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is that clarity, or seek for clarity, is the same as trying to tame the dragon.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Not always, kind of a Sanders thing, not always the best way to spend your time with dragons, right?
Yeah. It's a losing proposition.
What?
It's a losing proposition.
Yeah.
You'll never get it. You'll never get there.
Yeah. And that's sort of what I meant by the Ashbury thing, you know, better to stay cowering among the early lessons. So it's like, you know, never mind the dragons then if we can't control them. But that isn't the practice, I don't think. We'll take 10 more seconds and see, and then we'll call it a wrap if nothing else comes up. Okay. Thanks, everybody.